Welcome to the podcast of MotorWeek, television's original automotive magazine. MotorWeek is made possible by RockAuto.com. Here's your host, John Davis.
Thank you, Alec Webb, and welcome to our MotorWeek podcast number 70. And we're in Studio C at Maryland Public Television, where we are happy to produce MotorWeek every week. And sitting around our interview table today include our writer and two-wheeling reporter, Brian Robinson.
Happy to be here, John.
I think Brian has a permanent chair at this desk. Our over-the-edge reporter, Stephen Chupnik.
Hello.
And also our associate producer and head of our road test crew, Ben Davis.
Podcast 70. It makes me feel old.
70. Well, wait till you get there in years, buddy. All right. We're going to have our lightning round at the end of this podcast, and we'll also look at our mailbag. But first, we've got quite a bit of new hardware that we want to get through. And, Ben, I'm going to start with you. The Infiniti JX. This is Infiniti's new three-row, midsize crossover utility based, I guess you could say, on the new Nissan Pathfinder, or the Pathfinder will be based on it. Tell us about it.
Yeah, it's some much-needed competition sent towards Acura's way from Nissan.
For the MDX?
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. It uses the 3.5 liter, which we all know very well, and I personally am a big fan of. It starts at $40,000 for $40,450. it's loaded with technology. I think that's going to clinch a lot of people away from maybe looking at other competitors. It's got a 360-degree bird's-eye view camera.
That's pretty cool.
It's awesome for parking. You see in front of you, around you. It's insane. And if that wasn't enough, backup collision intervention. How many people need this these days?
Now, explain to me how that works.
It uses radar and sonar, and as long as you're under 5 miles an hour in a parking lot situation or coming out of your driveway, if it senses a kid on a big wheel or another vehicle, it'll alert you visually and audibly. If you don't do anything, it'll just stop the vehicle.
And it will stop you completely.
Cold stop. Mm-hmm. I tried it. I tried it with a trash can, but still.
Everybody around the table, you've probably seen it. They're running a lot of TV commercials. I surprised myself. I like the look of it. I didn't think I was going to, but it actually looks not bad.
I wouldn't say it's beautiful, but it can't be denied, that's for sure. It's stunning.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you can see cues from the M on there, the M35 and stuff. I've always kind of liked Infiniti's quirky
They have that wave kind of hood and like the grill, that kind of open mouth grill.
It's unique.
It is unique, and it looks expensive, which I guess all are real high quality points there.
It definitely does.
Does it have the CVT?
It does have a CVT behind it, yeah. 265 horsepower out of your V6. One of the cool features is a second row. You can put a car seat in the second row and actually still slide the second row forward enough for me to get into the third row.
Wow, really?
Which is pretty – I'm a pretty big dude.
So, see, it's going to go up against the MDX, Buick Enclave.
Q7 Audi.
Q7 Audi. Anything else?
That's really all I can think of.
Yeah, they seem to think Q7 and MDX were their biggest
I would think that would be correct, yeah. Okay, as folks out there listening, if you keep up with what's going on in the auto world, you probably know that Chrysler has taken their SRT, Street Racing Technology Division, and spun that off into a separate brand, all super high-performance models of other vehicles that they make.
Until the Viper comes out, which will be strictly SRT.
Cool.
And we had a chance to do both one car and one truck and sort of a combined test. We had the Jeep Grand Cherokee SRT8 and the Dodge Charger SRT8, which is just now called the Charger SRT8, if everyone's not confused. All right, 6.4 liter V8, lots of horsepower. But these two cars or vehicles were not really the same, were they?
Far from it. I wasn't a big fan of the SRT8 Cherokee. I thought it was a little bumpy on the highway.
Mean because it shows these fillings out of your teeth?
Didn't make a whole lot of sense.
That's the stiffest riding vehicle we've had in here in quite some time.
Probably 20 years.
My wife absolutely hated it. However, the Charger SRT8, I was really impressed with that. I didn't think it would be anywhere near what it was, but it's actually a car I highly desire now.
one of the members, it's so fast, one of the members of our staff who will remain nameless, shot out of the parking lot a couple days ago and had gotten maybe a block down the street. And we, the street leading up to our studios is 40 miles per hour. And he was well north of 60, and he didn't even know it. I mean, the car was deceptive. You go fast in that thing very quick.
The Charger is smooth.
Yeah,
those SRT seats in there with the matching door panel cloth and the quilted stitching. Yeah. It looks like a Bentley inside.
I should note that the policeman that stopped him let him off. I was impressed, and I took some friends of mine out for a weekend trip in it, and they were all impressed with how much room there was in the back seat, how comfortable a super high-performance car was, how quiet it was in the interior. And I still, and I'm fairly light on the accelerator, I still did over 20 miles per gallon, which really when you think about that kind of car is pretty amazing.
It's got like this cylinder deactivation, yep. I believe, that helps that out. Pretty impressive. Tons of fun for the money, I think.
Tons of quality for the money, too, I would
And the interior,
say.
They both have that huge screen that Dodges
huge.
Have now.
Yeah.
And with the SRTs, inches. You get a whole separate, like a track area with all kinds of performance data,
the one
which
in
is
the
pretty
Charger,
slick.
Yeah, the graphics on the one in the Charger were much more advanced than the one in the Grand Cherokee. I guess maybe that's on its way for Grand Cherokee.
Yeah, with that, I know that the same screen was in the 300 that we had a little mm-hmm. bit ago, but this... This screen, I mean, it just blended in to the dash. You almost didn't know when the car was off that it was
It didn't
there.
Look like something extra.
It was unbelievable. I mean, my wife was talking, you know, the interior in there. It was just the red and the black and the gray. It just all came together. She said this was the prettiest car she's ever seen.
Yeah, it looked like you'd drive up to the mall and you think you would need it valeted or something. It was so nice.
Did you crank the stereo in the Charger?
Beastly.
Oh, 19-speaker Harman Kardon. Yeah. Sound rains down on the unit there.
I did ask somebody at Chrysler why the Grand Cherokee was so stiff, and apparently part of their testing for any SRT product is 24 hours at a racetrack, just 24 hours straight.
Oh.
And so you're thinking, okay, the Jeep's taller, it's got more body roll, so you can sort of understand the stiffness. But me, that Charger SRT8 would be the one I would go for. Okay, let's move on now to something that is a little slower and a little not quite so large, but sort of the wave of the future. This is a new small sedan from Acura, the ILX. Brian, tell us what's this replacing and where does it fit in their lineup?
It's not really replacing anything. It's a new entry-level model for them. It's based on the Civic and shares a lot of things, a couple different powertrains, 2-liter i4, 2.4 liter i4, and of course the hybrid, which is the first for the Acura brand.
Now, will they won't have this and the TSX?
I wouldn't be so sure about that.
Really?
Yeah, I believe they have some different plans for the TSX.
Huh, interesting.
That they kind of hinted at. But anyway, like I say, it shares a lot of the Civic. Interior is certainly a step up. The interesting thing, the base 2-liter comes with a 5-speed automatic. The more high performance 2.4 liter comes with a 6-speed manual, but you can't get a manual on the 2-liter or automatic on the 2.4 liter.
Really? So just one transmission each?
Right. And they're really limiting themselves, I think, in that regard. But overall, it's pretty impressive. I mean, as you mentioned, this is about to be a big segment, I think, with fuel economy and maybe people that grew up, you know, in their parents' Lexuses and Acura, Mercedes, and then it comes time to buy their first car, and they don't make nearly as much money as their parents did, and they're like, whoa, I still want this kind of car. But so, you know, obviously better fuel economy, smaller luxury cars, I think, are going to be a strong wave in the future.
I agree. I mean, you look at the new Cadillac ATS, you know, everybody's coming out of the woodworks with something down in the true compact area. We all talk about them doing battle with the BMW 3 Series, but really this is just going to be almost a necessity. Buyers want something that's good-looking, has lots of luxury and performs very well, but doesn't take up a whole lot of space.
But the looks of it, and I saw, you know, the video and some pictures, there's nothing that actually stood out to me to really make, whoa, something like that. Was there anything in person that you saw?
I mean, it doesn't look like a Civic at all exterior-wise. I thought they did a pretty good job. I mean, we can get into a whole other debate about the Acura styling. It definitely looks accurate with the big shield on the front. And some more interesting lines going down the side. I think overall they did a good job with the exterior.
You know, we always get caught up with this. We like stylish vehicles for the most part. But the fact is most luxury car buyers don't want something that looks way out. They kind of want to be a little incognito.
I wouldn't be so sure about that.
Well,
I
mean, historically that's been true. Maybe the younger buyer is different.
Yeah, I wouldn't say they would go out there, but they do want their neighbors to be impressed with what
they
drive.
Arrived.
Yeah. So I think styling is somewhat important.
Yeah, but you know, you start looking at, say, mass market styling right now, which is getting to be very more and more overt, at least from some brands like Hyundai, to give you an example. And Acura is still fairly tame, and I guess Lexus is trying to be a little bit bolder with things like that new spindle grille.
So. Yeah.
But the ILX didn't strike you as being too tame?
It's borderline. I mean, there's nothing about it that really is exciting. Mm-hmm. But it's a very comfortable, well-equipped vehicle for $30,000. I think, you know, it clearly takes the Civic up a notch as far as, you know, a lot of standard features, moonroof and Bluetooth and push-button start.
Well-equipped.
Yeah, for $30,000. I mean, starts at 27.
What the TL has always done for them. It hasn't been the flashiest car in the lot, but it sold well because it was so well equipped and handled so well.
Right, and you get the Honda, you know, reliability to fall back on. So,
in a nutshell, it almost describes Honda in general.
In general, yeah. A little conservative, but you get a lot for your money, and they last for a long time.
And like Chubby was saying earlier, they always seem to come out in all these shootouts on top, lately anyway.
Another fun, very fun little all-wheel drive car that we had in recently, the Volkswagen Golf R. This also went to us with us to our winter testing facility in Georgia at Roebling Road. Gentlemen, Golf R, was it a disappointment? Were we excited? What happened?
I think we're split on this.
Yeah.
Oh, good. A little controversial.
I'll go first because I was disappointed.
Now that we should say this is the American spec of the car we've wanted from Europe for a long time.
Right, but it almost made me long. I wish we had had an older R32 there in place of this. It felt to me it didn't stir up the same emotions through the exhaust. It was a little softer around the track, and it didn't have the uniqueness to its design that the R32s used to have.
So are you saying it didn't have any ragged edges and you missed that?
Yeah, I missed the different skirting, maybe the little lower stance. It didn't look like a performance edition to me as much as the R32 used to.
Yeah, it's definitely a little more mild-mannered as far as daily driving, but on the track, I think it blows the R32 away. I mean, the thing handled like crazy. It's got the latest version of the 4-motion all-wheel drive, which sends up to 100% of torque to the rear wheels. So, I mean, going around the track, you could hammer the thing and even get the rear end out a little bit, which you could never – well, at least I couldn't achieve in the R32. But 6-speed manual only, which, again, Volkswagen wants to hold stuff back in Europe for whatever reason. We can't get the DSG here, which I haven't driven, but most people say is really nice.
Yeah, it was weird on the R32. It was DSG only, the last R32.
Correct.
It's
and then we complained about that.
And then now I drove it, and I loved it.
They're like, here you go.
Now I want the DSG.
Yeah. So I don't know, but I thought it was a blast, and it's a half a second quicker in a quarter mile than the R32, which, you know, you can't argue with that.
R32 just sounded better from the front and louder out of the back.
I can't remember the last time we had an all-wheel drive performance car where you could dump 100%, you know, front-wheel drive based, where you could dump 100% of the torque to the rear wheels. That was pretty impressive. It made it handle a lot different.
You could definitely feel it, which, you know, it's one thing to say that it does that, but when you can feel it working like that, it's pretty impressive.
Yeah, that's cool.
It definitely looked good on the track, coming around, even to the straightaway around the turns. It
didn't look like a Volkswagen.
It did not. It didn't until you got closer to it that it you could tell that it was – that shape.
And actually from it looked like it was one of the more secure cars we were tested.
Yeah, I'll agree that it wasn't quite rough around the edges, but it feels more of a factory effort, where the R32 kind of felt aftermarket-y, if that makes any sense, you know.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense.
Good. We have a split. That's always good once in a while. Keeps us honest. Okay, let's turn now to our lightning round, where our Motor Week panelists have the opportunity to share their opinions on topics making headlines. And we'll have 2 minutes to debate, and if we all mind our manners, which I usually don't, when the bell rings, time will be up. And Michelle's going to take care of the bell honors today, as she usually does. Okay, it's a long piece, so stay with me here. Cadillac has a new safety feature that uses vibrations instead of annoying beeping sounds to alert drivers to danger. So just where will you feel these vibrations, or where would you like to feel these vibrations? Yeah. In the seat of your pants? Are these vibrations really very distracting behind the wheel and adding to the problem? Do we really need something like this? What do you think, guys? More distraction or a better way to go to let you know something's going on?
I'd say with all the visual and audible distractions that we already have behind the wheel with, you know, everybody you look at on the highways texting or talking on their phone, we do need another stimulus. And you know, a vibrating seat is something that you can't really mistake for anything else. I mean, short of blasting little bursts of sulfur into somebody's nose behind the wheel, I think this is a pretty good alternative.
Yeah, I mean, there's other cars and luxury brands that are giving feedback through the wheel, I believe. I'm not familiar with any through the seat. I agree we do need something. I'm not sure. I mean, you need to make sure that everything's right. I know we have a long-term Jeep Grand Cherokee that gives you – either I'm a really bad driver or what, but I get collision warnings on that thing all the time. And it gets annoying.
It's the radar.
I was getting them on that Charger SRT all the time.
Yeah, if it would have vibrated or something, then I would have really made me mad.
But it's just something different.
That's
and
a good
and
point.
I know that even with the steering wheel, sometimes I'm like, okay, I'm doing that. But I think if you felt it somewhere other than the steering wheel, something with your hands or something, it's like, whoa, you know, so it might wake you up a little
bit. I phase it out.
Pardon?
You would get used to it and phase it out. That's why we got to bring the sulfur blasts in.
You know, I mean, the first time I ever drove a Mercedes that had a steering wheel vibration, I think it was I was actually somewhere overseas driving it. And I have to admit, I'm talking to whoever's in the car with me, and it shocked the hell out of me. It was like, what? Whoa, wait, where's that come from? Because I hadn't really paid much attention to it. So it did its job of getting your attention focused. And after that, I have to say it was sort of an annoyance.
Right.
So
once you get used to it.
You were looking for a way to shut it off.
Well, exactly what Ben said is that once you get used to it, it'll just be something else. And then you'll be like, I'm in the lane or whatever.
You never get used to that sulfur.
Well, I think we've pretty much exhausted that. Thank you, Michelle. Let's go on now to our Motor Week mailbag. And this question comes from John Hamilton. When the government puts down the MPG on a car or truck, and we assume John is talking about the label on the side of the car when it's new, what speed is used on the highway? Let me preface this by saying that these government tests are actually tests that are done to measure emissions and environmental things, and they deduce miles per gallon from that. Anybody know the answer?
Well, I mean, I do, but you.
Well, go ahead.
John would probably rather hear from you.
No, I don't think so. I'll just back you up. I'll tell you if you're wrong.
I think they put it on rollers or whatever. They get it up to
speed.
It's
on a dyno of some
type. Yeah, they get it up to like 60 as quick as possible, and then they fluctuate between like 40 and 60, I believe. Is that?
Yeah, that's basically it.
A 10-mile loop?
They do a city loop, and they do a highway loop, and then they do some other supplemental tests. I think I looked it up, but the average speed for the highway test is 48.3 through this entire 10-mile cycle.
Which doesn't seem very realistic.
And they never get over 60.
70, 75 if, you know.
And they do a high-speed test, which is relatively new. It's only a few years old. And there they get up to 80, but they still basically have a fairly low average speed of about 48. And I guess they don't use that because it's probably not mandated and would cause a lot of – it would certainly drop the fuel economy numbers like a stone because they – what's the old adage? For every 5 miles you gain in speed, you lose 2 miles per gallon in fuel economy, something like that. And but the answer to your question, John, is for the highway rating, as Brian said, they get up to about a maximum of 60. The average speed is in the high 40s. And it's not very realistic. So when you see that number, the number that we use more and more here at the show is not the city number and not the highway number. It's what's called the combined number, which is now on the new labels. It generally hasn't been used in public as much. But now if you look on the label, you'll see the combined number. And it's not an average of city and highway. It's close to an average, but it's a very realistic number compared to the other two. Very much these days we see cars that have a city number in the low 20s and a highway number up around 40.
Yeah, they're big spreads, I guess, because of six-speed transmissions with like double overdrives and cylinder deactivation, stuff like that really boosts the highway mileage, which the new numbers are certainly better. I mean, I remember a few years ago with the old numbers, we would never seem to be able to match like the combined number. We pretty much always match it now, sometimes beat it. So the new numbers are, I think, a lot more realistic.
But look at that combined number. That's the number to look at. And chances are, unless you're a lead foot, you're going to get there. Okay, thank you, John. Thank you, everybody sitting around the table. I want to give a thanks also to our audio engineer, Jim Bigwood, our podcast creator, Bob Mixter, our producer, Michelle Parker, the lady with the bell. Writer and two-wheeling reporter Brian Robinson has been with us today, along with our over-the-edge reporter Stephen Chepnick and our associate producer and head road test guy Ben Davis. I'm John Davis, no relation. And thank you very much for listening to our Motor Week podcast. Be sure to catch Motor Week on your local public television station and also on the cable channel Velocity. Till next time, I am John Davis, and we are Motor Week, and we hope you'll join us again soon.
You've been listening to the podcast of Motor Week, television's original automotive magazine. Motor Week is made possible by RockAuto.com. For additional information on podcasts, videos, and showtimes, visit our website at MotorWeek.org. And watch Motor Week, television's longest-running automotive series, each week on your local PBS station.